So good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Nice to see everyone resurfacing after summer holidays, travels. The days are getting shorter. It's still summertime. We're still enjoying it. But in a few weeks, the season will turn, and we'll start our fall practice period. I think we actually start right on the equinox, actually, this year. I don't think we've done that before. For those of you who are new to the idea of practice period, it's a time. I think it'll be actually 8 weeks this year, where we kind of strengthen and intensify our practice. And each person, I mean, if we were all in a monastery together, we'd all do the same thing. But we're not in a monastery. We have jobs and families. So each person kind of makes their personal commitment to what they'll do during that practice period. We begin with a weekend retreat. We end with our residential Sesshin at Loon Lake, and you'll learn more about what we're going to be doing. But each person kind of makes their own commitment, and you can register and kind of write that down. And on our opening evening, each person kind of says a little bit about their personal intention for the practice period. Our theme this year is going to be koans, those ancient Zen teaching stories and dialogues that many people find rather frustrating and intimidating and even inaccessible at first encounter. So I thought we'd get warmed up with one today. During the practice period, we're going to look at the koans of a collection called the Gateless Barrier, or the Mumon Kan. But the one that I've brought today isn't from that collection. It's in both the two longer collections, the Blue Cliff Record and the Book of Serenity. Blue Cliff Record being, generally speaking, a Rinzai collection, and Book of Serenity, a Soto collection. And unlike many of the koans, which are kind of depict encounters between Tang Dynasty Zen masters and their students, or each other. This one features Vimalakirti, who was a legendary lay practitioner who lived at the time of the Buddha and was renowned for the depth of his understanding of the Dharma. So this koan is really an excerpt from the Vimalakirti Sutra, which was an early Mahayana text believed to have been first written down around the year 100 of the Common Era in Sanskrit. But it's likely that the legend of Vimalakirti had been passed down and embellished orally for some time before that. We don't really know, because he doesn't appear in the early Pali texts, so he's a bit of a mystery. He was said to be a rich patron of the Buddha, and to have had a wife and a son and a daughter, but renowned for his enlightenment. I shouldn't say but, and renowned for his enlightenment. And we have a study group among the people who have been shuso, or practice leader, for a practice period before. So we're trying to get together almost monthly and study some of the basic texts, and we've been looking at the Vimalakirti Sutra. So that's what prompted this talk, and it'll be in Michael's next week. But I also realized that he appears in these koans, or this particular koan. So I'm going to read you the koan first, and then I'll give you a little bit more of the background. It's a dialogue between Vimalakirti and Manjushri, who's the Bodhisattva of wisdom. So Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, what is a Bodhisattva's method of entering non-duality? Manjushri answers, according to my mind, in all things, no speech, no explanation, no direction, and no representation, leaving behind all questions and answers. This is the method of entering non-duality. And then he says, each of us has spoken, and he's referring to a whole host of bodhisattvas who have gathered, and each has given his or her own answer to this question, how does one enter the gate of non-duality? So each of the bodhisattvas has presented to Vimalakirti. Manjushri says, now you should say, good man, what is a bodhisattva's method of entry into non-duality? Vimalakirti was silent. So that's the koan. Sometimes it's referred to as Vimalakirti's thunderous silence. And it's seen as a sort of quintessential Zen teaching. Right? What's beyond words? So the setting for this encounter is a room in Vimalakirti's house. He has deliberately allowed himself to become ill, and he uses his own illness as a means to teach about the impermanence of the human body, about emptiness, and thus about wisdom and compassion. So the Buddha hears about this. The Buddha hears that Vimalakirti is ill. So he calls his disciples and asks them to visit Vimalakirti and see how he is. Oh, I forgot to mention, while Michael and I were away hiking and camping for a couple of weeks, Claire did a talk on Vimalakirti on a Wednesday evening. And unfortunately, it didn't get recorded, so we don't really know what she said. So if anyone was there, please forgive me if I'm redundant. because we really enjoyed studying this Vimalakirti Sutra. It's a wonderful story. So the Buddha asks his disciples to go pay a visit to Vimalakirti and see how he is. And one after another, the disciple makes up an excuse about how once when he was preaching some aspect of the Dharma to a group of lay people, Vimalakirti showed up and said essentially, you shouldn't say it that way. Here's how you should say it. And then leaves the disciple in the dust with his brilliant, his wisdom and eloquence. So each disciple would say, sorry, but when Vimalakirti expounded the Dharma, he inspired 800 lay people to take up the practice, so I'm not competent to visit him and inquire about his illness. So this goes on, this is a whole long chapter of each bodhisattva making excuses. The Vimalakirti Sutra is one of the few Buddhist texts that is actually humorous. Because it's a layperson showing up, all these distinguished disciples, not to mention them, the bodhisattvas show up, and he shows them up too. So it kind of pokes fun. So after all the disciples refuse to go, the Buddha calls a whole host of bodhisattvas with extravagant names like Virtue Guardian, Good Constellation, Lion Will, and Lightning God, who likewise make excuses about how Vimalakirti showed them up. In the course of these dialogues, then, each one quotes Vimalakirti, so we get to hear his teachings. So it's a skillful device used in the composition of the sutra. And we could spend a lot more time. You could really go into detail reading this. But we're going to stay with the plot for now. Finally, Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, agrees to the Buddha's command to visit Vimalakirti, even though he too is intimidated. Then, now when word gets out that there's going to be a meeting between the great Bodhisattva Manjushri and Vimalakirti, a great crowd assembles. I'll quote now, then the Bodhisattvas and the major disciples in the assembly, the Brahmas, Indras, and four heavenly kings all thought to themselves, now these two great men, Manjushri and Vimalakirti, will be talking together and they will surely expound the wonderful Dharma. At that time, 8,000 Bodhisattvas, 500 voice hearers, and hundreds and thousands of heavenly beings all decided at once that they would like to accompany Manjushri on his visit. So they all crowded into Vimalakirti's sick room, and miraculously there was room for everyone. Manjushri asks Vimalakirti how he's doing, much as we might ask a friend who's in the hospital or laid up with an illness at home. He says, "Layman, this illness of yours, can you endure it? Is the treatment perhaps not making it worse rather than better?" You know, sometimes we ask that. The world-honored one, that's the Buddha, countless times has made solicitous inquiries concerning you. Layman, what is the cause of this illness? Has it been with you long? And how can it be cured? But Vimalakirti answers quite differently from the average person's account of symptoms and treatments. Vimalakirti says, "This illness of mine is born of ignorance and feelings of attachment. Because all living beings are sick, therefore I am sick. If all living beings are relieved of sickness, then my sickness will be mended. Why? Because the Bodhisattva, for the sake of living beings, enters the realm of birth and death. And because he is in the realm of birth and death, he suffers illness. If living beings can gain release from illness, then the Bodhisattva will no longer be ill. It is like the case of a rich person who has only one child. If the child falls ill, then the father or mother too will suffer. But if the child's illness is cured, the father and mother too will be cured. The Bodhisattva is like this, for he loves living beings as though they were his children. If living beings are sick, the Bodhisattva will be sick. And if living beings are cured, the Bodhisattva too will be cured. You ask what cause this illness arises from. The illness of the Bodhisattva arises from his great compassion." When I read this passage, it reminded me of an interview I read years ago with a Catholic nun who worked with people with HIV/AIDS in the early years of the epidemic, when there was so much fear, ignorance, and stigma around the illness. The interview asked her, if Christ was alive today, how would he respond to AIDS? And she answered, Christ would have AIDS. His full embracing of the illness would be a Bodhisattva's gift of no fear. So if we are to walk the path of the Bodhisattva, which is living in this world where there is so much suffering, in a way that doesn't increase harm and is a benefit to others, those are our Bodhisattva vows, right? We will feel the suffering of others. We will suffer ourselves. And we will sometimes weep the tears of a Bodhisattva, because we are embodied human beings. We will encounter the challenges of sickness, old age, and death. And we will do our best to meet those challenges fully with wisdom and compassion, so that our way of living is our teaching. So Manjushri questions Vimalakirti further about his illness. He says, "This illness of yours, layman, what form does it take?" "My illness has no form," replied Vimalakirti, it cannot be seen. Is this illness seated in the body or in the mind? It is not seated in the body, for it is apart from bodily form. And it is not seated in the mind, for the mind is phantom-like, a phantom-like thing. Of the four major elements, earth, water, fire, and air, to which of these elements does this illness pertain? Manjushri asks. Vimalakirti says, this illness does not pertain to the element earth, but neither is it separated from the element earth. And the same way with the elements of water, fire, and air. Yet the illnesses of living beings arise from the four elements, and because living beings have these illnesses, therefore I too am ill. So I think what he's suggesting here is that the illness is the human condition itself. It is living in a body subject to sickness, old age, and death. A body-mind, living with a body-mind that exists only in relationship to all other existence, other beings. Conditioned by kalpas and kalpas of karma. Kalpas, for those of you who are unfamiliar with that word, is an unimaginably long period of time. The illness is our always wanting the human condition to be otherwise than it is right now. So next comes a passage I find deeply moving and comforting and encouraging. The life of a bodhisattva is a path, not a destination. And even an experienced bodhisattva can sometimes become weary and discouraged, assailed by doubt and heartache. So Manjushri asks Vimalakirti, how should a bodhisattva comfort and instruct another bodhisattva who is ill? And Vimalakirti says, tell her about the impermanence of the body, but do not tell her to despise or turn away from the body. Tell her about the sufferings of the body, but do not tell her to strive for nirvana. Tell her that the body is without ego, but urge her to teach and guide living beings. Tell her of the emptiness of the body, but do not tell her of its final extinction. And by that he means not just death, but the final kind of stepping off the wheel of life and death that a Buddha, attaining full Buddhahood. So to let go of that goal and live in this world is what this says. Tell her to repent of former offenses, but do not tell her to consign them to the past. So to fully acknowledge harm or wrong that we've done, but not to say, oh, that's past, not forget. Tell her to use her own illness as a means of empathizing with the illness of others, for she should understand their sufferings through the countless kalpas of their past existence and should think how she can bring benefit to all living beings. Tell her to recall the good fortune she has won through spiritual practice, to concentrate on a life of purity and not give way to gloom or worry. She should cultivate constant diligence, striving to become a master of physician. It says king of physicians, a master physician who can heal the ailments of the assembly. This is how a bodhisattva should comfort and instruct a bodhisattva who is ill so as to make her feel happy. So sometimes we really need encouragement like that. The bodhisattva path is not easy and the pitfalls are many. So we need to maintain our practice with steadfastness and wholeheartedness and good companionship. you know, for when we waver. So Manjushri wants to know more. He asks, layman, how should a bodhisattva who is ill go about tempering and controlling the mind? Vimalakirti says, a bodhisattva who is ill should think to himself, now these illnesses of mine all spring from the deluded thoughts, the upside-down thinking, and various earthly desires of my existence. They have no real existence, so who is it who suffers illness? Why? The four major elements come together, and therefore we apply a makeshift name. You know, we call it Kate, Michael, or Ben. Four elements came together and made this person, calling the thing a body. But the four major elements have no master, and the body has no I or ego. And these illnesses, too, all arise from attachment to ego. Therefore, I should harbor no such attachment to ego. So I'm going to paraphrase the next section because it's quite long. And he continues, to let go of attachment to ego, one should let go of the thought that phenomena have solidity and permanence, and see them as simply arising and passing away. So that what that means is our ego, our ego can function. We need a certain amount of, an ego serves a functioning purpose, but we can see that it's provisional and it's conditioned and it changes. That it isn't, there's no concreteness to it at all. So to do that, he then says, we have to let go of dualistic thinking. So what does that mean? He says, it means not thinking of phenomena as internal or external, but treating all as equal. What is meant by equal? It means that I and nirvana are treated as equal. Why? Because I and nirvana are both empty. So nirvana we think of as this perfect state of serenity, of being free from obstruction. Here's saying, don't attach to either this imperfect self that we have that we're so dissatisfied with, or nirvana, that both are constructs. Both are mere names, hence empty. Neither of these two phenomena has any fixed nature or characteristics. Once one has acquired this kind of equal outlook, one will be freed of all other illness and will have only the illness of emptiness. And the illness of emptiness, too, is empty. So, don't get attached to emptiness. This ailing bodhisattva of ours has no sensations of pain or pleasure, and yet she allows herself to feel such sensations. And while the Buddha Dharma is incompletely practiced, so that means in this world where the Buddha Dharma is imperfectly practiced by us human beings, the bodhisattva does not seek to wipe out such sensations in herself and gain entry into final enlightenment. If she feels pain in her body, she thinks of the living beings in the realms of suffering and summons up a mind of great compassion and guides suffering beings to cut off the source of illness. What is meant by the source of illness? It means having troublesome entanglements. And how does one cut them off? By realizing that there is nothing to grasp at, nothing we can hold on to, nothing at all. What is meant by realizing there is nothing to grasp at? It means letting go of dualistic views. Viewing this as internal, viewing that as external. This is, you know, mine, us and them, yours and mine, black and white. So many kinds of dualistic thinking. So here he is coming back again to that gate of non-duality. which is the question of the koan. Next he goes into an interesting passage where he warns, and again I'm going to paraphrase this, he warns that if our compassion for the suffering of other beings is tinged or contaminated with self-clinging, we will experience what in contemporary language is called compassion fatigue. Some of you have heard of that phrase, compassion fatigue. This contamination could take the form of like over-identification with the other person, or with an inner fear or discomfort that fuels our need to relieve their suffering, or a need to keep that relationship with the person, or a need to be seen as a powerful and effective healer. There's all many different gross and subtle ways that our kind of self clinging can contaminate our compassion, which doesn't mean that we have to hold back and wait till we're absolutely perfect and pure to express and feel compassion. It's just we need to be aware of it. We need to be aware of it. And a sign is compassion fatigue. You know, when a little resentment creeps in, when you're feeling exhausted, and those are always warnings or little signals that we need to look more deeply into our own, what are we attaching, what are we clinging to in terms of our own identity and needs. So I thought this was pretty impressive, that he brings this point up, you know, even so many centuries and centuries ago. And here's where a kind of scrupulous self-awareness, practice of self-awareness, is really essential on the bodhisattva path. Vimalakirti says, the bodhisattva is not bound by the conditions of his birth, and hence he is able to preach the Dharma for living beings and liberate them from their bonds. So when we're really fully present with obstacles, all the many obstacles fall away, we are no longer bound by the conditions of our birth. All that story of limitation that we carry around with us drops away. He says, if one is in bonds himself, how does he suppose he can free others from their bonds? But if one is himself free of bonds, it is perfectly reasonable to assume he can free the bonds of others. That doesn't mean necessarily a kind of interventionist approach. It means by your own being free, it gives a gift of freedom to others. Sometimes interventions are appropriate, but this doesn't imply, you know, an interventionist approach. And he says, therefore, the bodhisattva must not conjure up bonds for himself. It's pretty easy to conjure up bonds, isn't it? You know, all the kind of stories that we say, and, you know, well, I can do this, I can't do that. Our habit patterns are strong. So that's why we really need our bodhisattva vows and our practice to support us on the path. We need all the advice and encouragement we can get. So here's a little bit more from Vimalakirti. Says, what is meant by bonds and what is meant by liberation? To become infatuated with the taste of meditation is the bondage of the bodhisattva. It's to become infatuated with the taste of meditation. So he's implying that the bodhisattva can get caught by the peace and tranquility of meditation and not be present in the world. To be born in this world as a form of skillful means is the liberation of the bodhisattva. So to have the capacity to actually fully live in this world and meet each being, each situation with a kind of open-heartedness and freedom is the liberation of the bodhisattva. So he says, wisdom without skillful means is bondage. Wisdom with skillful means is liberation. Skillful means without wisdom is bondage. Skillful means with wisdom is liberation. So I think many of you know wisdom and skillful means are two of what are called the paramitas, which are practices of, they're bodhisattva practices that we kind of intentionally cultivate, along with generosity, ethics, patience, energy, meditation. Those are paramitas. So Vimalakirti is warning us not to be attached to one without the other, that to wisdom without the skillful means, or skillful means without the wisdom. And we could include compassion side by side with wisdom. That if we have any unbalance in our practice, that we will lose that capacity to respond with flexibility and openness to what's around us. Manjushri, the ailing bodhisattva should view all phenomena in this way. He should view the body and realize that it is marked by impermanence, suffering, emptiness, and absence of ego. This is called wisdom. But though his body may be ailing, he should constantly abide in the realm of birth and death, bringing benefit to all living beings and never giving in to weariness or revulsion. This is called skillful means. Though he moves in the realm of emptiness, he plants many roots of virtue. Such is the practice of the bodhisattva. Though he moves in the realm of formlessness, yet he saves many living beings. Such is the practice of the bodhisattva. Though he moves in the realm of non-action, he manifests himself by taking on a body. Such is the practice of the bodhisattva. Though he practices the paramitas, he can understand the minds and mental activities of all living beings. Such is the practice of the bodhisattva. Though aware that all things in the end are pure in nature, he responds to circumstances by showing himself in bodily form. Such is the practice of the bodhisattva. So that's just a short sampling. This actually goes on and on. A long list of such is the practice of the bodhisattva. But the overarching theme is to live in this world without being snagged by our desires and aversions, letting go of dualistic thinking, and through our letting go to support others to let go. So as you can see, Vimalakirti actually has quite a lot to say about non-duality. Despite his famously thunderous silence on the matter. That response to Manjushri, his response that's in the koan, actually comes a little later in the sutra. I'm tempted to say with some irreverence that he just simply ran out of steam. Or he thought, if they haven't gotten it by now, there's nothing more I can say. But first, he does have even more to say about how a bodhisattva regards and responds to sentient beings living in the world. And so Michael's going to actually tell you some more next week about how Vimalakirti advises us to live in the world. And but I think, like all those disciples and all those bodhisattvas of long ago, we can use all the advice and encouragement we can get. And it's kind of inspiring, I think, to get it from Vimalakirti, who lived in the world. He wasn't a monk, he didn't live in a monastery, he had a family and he had work. All those many years ago, just like we do. So I thought you might enjoy getting acquainted with him today. So thank you for listening, and to be continued next week.
Page 3 to chant the closing chant. May